Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 8th of July, these are our main stories. Hong Kong's government has banned all political activity in schools just hours after China opened an office in the territory to enforce stringent new national security laws. China and the US have become embroiled in a new visa row over Tibet. We'll find out why. And the world-famous writers denouncing cancel culture. Also in this podcast, the Netherlands returns artifacts taken from its former colony Indonesia, but keeps one very precious diamond. And
it's a bit like a science fiction movie, the aftermath of some sort of apocalypse, because the whole place is just completely locked down. You are scanned and sanitised.
The return of test cricket, but with a difference. Victoria Park in Hong Kong has been something of a rallying point for pro-democracy demonstrators, and it's now overlooked by China's new National Security Office, which was officially opened on Wednesday. That's the Chinese national anthem, which was played as the country's flag was raised outside the office from which Chinese intelligence agents will operate openly in Hong Kong for the first time. The inauguration was attended by Zhang Yangxiang, the man Beijing chose to head the new office, and by Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam. Speaking in Mandarin, the language of Beijing, and not Cantonese, the main language of Hong Kong.
Today's unveiling ceremony is a historic moment because we're witnessing another milestone in the establishment of a sound legal system. Having a law to follow is the starting point of safeguarding national security. We must ensure that the law will be enforced strictly, and whoever breaks the law will be held accountable.
Our reporter Martin Yip is in Hong Kong.
All these things were only shown to the public almost an hour after the event. There was no live broadcast. Members of the press were able to film the events from at least 50 metres away. And if you look from that perspective, you would see kind of a heavy security with very big, what they call the water barricades. It's completely sealed up area in the middle of the street that this ceremony was held. This whole compound for now would be possibly under a very heavy security presence. And this is security presence provided by the Hong Kong police.
And what functions will this new office carry out in Hong Kong?
This is a commission set up by the central government in Beijing. They put it in Hong Kong. It would carry out works like analysing intelligence about national security in Hong Kong. But the most controversial part, probably, is it would have the right to decide if any cases are deemed to be over Hong Kong's capability to deal with. Say, if they see any kind of national security crime, as they see it, is too big for Hong Kong to handle, then they would take the initiative to investigate the case, and then the case would be tried in mainland China.
And since Beijing brought in this new national security law, you are seeing new restrictions being introduced, aren't you, such as in schools?
Yeah, that's mainly instructions sent up by the Education Bureau itself to local schools, demanding them to keep a close eye on students, including behaviours deemed to be in violation of this law, such as chanting political slogans. They are not exactly talking about sending them to the police right away, but they do demand schools to keep a tight eye on students carrying out any activities that are deemed political. And they request schools to carry out what they call disciplinary actions on these students. But just that is good enough to for those who are in support of the protests over the past year to feel some sort of chilling effect, especially when we saw so many young people and students getting into the street over the past year to protest against the government, which began with the demonstration against the piece of law that might extradite people to mainland China, which has now scrapped. But we end up with this new piece of national security law that might officially enable Beijing to extradite people to mainland China for trial without even going through Hong Kong court.
That was Martin Yip in Hong Kong. The tensions between China and the United States have intensified in a growing row over Tibet. Washington initiated this row by announcing travel restrictions on Chinese officials involved in banning foreigners from going to Tibet. In response, China hit back with a similar measure, putting visa restrictions on US officials. So why? Michael Bristow is our Asia Pacific editor.
Introducing this restriction under a law which came in 2018, which essentially seeks to put pressure on China over its actions in Tibet. This specific law, these specific visa restrictions, concentrate on China's refusal to allow journalists, tourists and diplomats to travel to Tibet to see the place for themselves. But it's part, as the US sees it, as a broader pattern of human rights abuses carried out by China in Tibet. And so it wants to put pressure on Beijing to change its policies there. China responded quite angrily, as you indicated there, and it's imposing similar visa restrictions on US officials involved in some way in Tibet.
And the two countries have been embroiled in a lot of diplomatic disagreements recently, haven't they?
They have. This has got to be seen as part of a broader attack by the United States on China, really, to force it to change its behaviour. We've seen the Trump administration go after Beijing on all kinds of issues, including trade, the South China Sea, and particularly on human rights issues. Over the last couple of years, we've had the United States bringing in sanctions and restrictions on China for its actions in Xinjiang. That's where Chinese authorities have imprisoned hundreds of thousands of Muslim Uyghurs. And also in Hong Kong, China's efforts there, as we've just been hearing, to control what goes on there more. The Americans are angry about that and imposing restrictions because of those. So really, these restrictions over Tibet should be seen as a broader attack and push by the United States to try and force China to change its behaviour when it comes to human rights.
Michael Bristow. Two issues have dominated world news in recent months, COVID-19 and the US presidential election. The interplay between the two has been fascinating. Coronavirus has thrown President Trump's campaign effort into turmoil, and in recent weeks, it seemed that a new issue, race, is being put at the centre of his re-election campaign. Our North America editor John Sopel looks at how this strategy is working.
The strategy of the Trump campaign was to fight the election on the towering strength of the US economy. But with 11% now unemployed, that's not going to work. It was then going to be Trump, the Churchillian war leader, navigating America to safety by fighting coronavirus on the beaches and the landing fields. But though the US is leading the world in COVID-19, it's for all the wrong reasons. And so something else was needed. The Independence Day weekend is typically when the president focuses on all that unites Americans. But at Mount Rushmore, Donald Trump was more interested in us and them.
Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. Angry mobs are trying to tear down statues of our founders, deface our most sacred memorials, and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities.
He's followed up this week with an attack on America's only top-level black NASCAR racing driver, Bubba Wallace. A noose had been found in the garage that had been assigned to him at a racetrack where he'd been due to drive. The FBI investigated and determined it wasn't a hate crime. Wallace thanked the FBI for looking into it. Case closed. Except Donald Trump demanded that Wallace should apologise. For what was unclear, and even some of his most ardent admirers said Wallace had nothing to apologise for. The president also claimed that NASCAR ratings had plummeted since the racing franchise banned Confederate flags from racetracks, the most potent symbol of 19th century white supremacy. He then moved from motor racing to American football and an attack on two teams, the Washington Redskins and the Cleveland Indians. They're under pressure to change their names because of the derogatory terms used to describe Native Americans. The president says they're being weak and politically correct. So what's going on here? The president seems to be replaying the 1968 playbook of Richard Nixon.
As we look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame. We see Americans hating each other, fighting each other, killing each other at home. And as we see and hear these things, millions of Americans cry out in anguish, did we come all this way for this?
The so-called Southern strategy works on the insight that the more you talk about race, the more you'll mobilise white, working class, less educated voters to turn out for your side. In recent weeks, Donald Trump has repeatedly tweeted two words, silent majority, and another with three words, law and order.
Joe Biden is leading President Trump in several key battleground states.
But so far, it doesn't seem to be cutting through. Latest polls show Biden way out in front in all the key states where this election will be decided. And though the Trump campaign dismissed the polls, let me use another phrase made famous from the Nixon era, follow the money. The Trump campaign is spending millions on ads in Georgia, Texas, and Ohio that should be rock-solid Republican states. This suggests that he has serious problems approaching the November election. Though his campaign might have settled on a strategy, there's no evidence that it's working yet.
John Sopel, our North America editor. Police in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, who are searching for one of the country's most wanted gangsters, Vikas Dubey, say they've shot dead one of his closest aides, Amar Dubey. Here's Jill McGivering.
Pictures of Amar Dubey show a smartly dressed young man with a moustache, posing astride a motorbike and smiling beside gang leader Vikas Dubey. Police accused Amar Dubey of opening fire on Friday when the gang ambushed a team who'd gone to arrest them. Eight police officers died. It's still unclear who tipped off the gang, but dozens of officers at a local police station have been transferred. A massive hunt is now underway for Vikas Dubey, who is accused of multiple counts of murder, kidnapping and extortion.
John McGivering. Earlier this year, the Netherlands returned to Indonesia thousands of precious artefacts which had been captured during Dutch colonial rule. But one very important item was missing from the list, a huge 36-carat diamond from the island of Borneo that still resides in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Now, descendants of the Sultan who once owned the diamond are fighting to get it returned and are being supported by a Dutch historian. Rebecca Henschke reports from Indonesia.
The huge diamond sits sparkling in a glass cabinet in Amsterdam's top art museum, surrounded by oil paintings. When Dutch historian Caroline Driesenhuizen came across it, it was simply labelled the Banjarmasin diamond.
It's a big diamond. It was there, and I was just thinking about it, just like I think about a lot of objects from Indonesia and Dutch museums. How did it get there? Why is it in the museum? What's the story behind it? So, yeah, I really wanted to find that out.
She delved into the archives as part of a larger effort by the museum to tell the story of controversial objects in its collection. What she found out was that in 1859, the people of Banjarmasin on the island of Borneo in Indonesia were punished for revolting against Dutch colonial rule.
People were arrested, other people were murdered. There was a lot of tension, there was a lot of violence. Well, the diamond of Banjarmasin was taken by the Dutch to the Netherlands to sell it or give it to King Willem III. But the king didn't want it because it was too expensive to cut it and to polish it. Eventually, it ended up in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
Even if we tried, it would be very hard to find a diamond that size in Borneo now, says Ahmad Fikri, the representative of the Sultan. He stands looking over the floating markets on the mighty rivers that surround Banjarmasin. Traders sell fruit, vegetables and meat from their wooden boats in the same way they have for centuries. Indonesia gained independence from the Dutch shortly after the end of the Second World War, but it wasn't until 2010 that the Sultan here was re-established. And now, Ahmad says, they want their property back.
It's not only the diamond. There are also thrones and other artifacts that we don't have all the exact details of that were taken by the Dutch. We want them all to be returned because our kingdom deserved to have what was taken from us returned.
Back in Borneo, historians say the diamond is priceless, and having it returned home would be monumental. It would mean, they say, that the next generation can see it and reclaim a part of their history.
Rebecca Henschke reporting from Indonesia. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
Some of those stories I will certainly take to my grave. Their experiences were harrowing. We learnt about damaged families under immense strain.
The health scandals caused by a failure to listen to women patients. Government forces in Burkina Faso have been fighting armed groups with links to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State for 3 years, a conflict that has seen almost 1 million people displaced. Now, Human Rights Watch says the bodies of 180 men have been found in a mass grave in the north. The report says they were probably victims of extrajudicial killings by the army. Celestina Olulade from our Africa service told us more.
What we know is that at least 180 men have been found in these mass graves. And one community leader described these men as dead men, blindfolded with their hands up. And this was just on the outskirts of the northern town of Djibou. Now, the residents say that they found victims under bridges and fields before burying them in mass communal graves. And many of the locals actually believe that these victims belong to the Fulani ethnic community, who very often are targeted by security forces because of their perceived links to Islamist insurgents.
And the government has been accused of human rights abuses before, hasn't it?
Yes, that is the case. So back in 2019, Human Rights Watch claimed that security forces executed 115 civilians in operations against jihadist militants. And this is between April 2018 and January 2019.
And just finally, has the government of Burkina Faso had anything to say about this Human Rights Watch report?
The government has told Human Rights Watch that they will investigate the claims. And the Minister of Defence, Mumima Sharif Sai, says that these killings could have been committed by armed groups using stolen army uniforms. So there's an investigation that is due to be carried out. So we're hoping to get more on this.
Celestina Olulade from our Africa service. First, do no harm. The starting principle we hope our doctors will abide by when they treat their patients. It's also the title of a report today in the UK that concludes that the lives of tens of thousands of women and children have been catastrophically harmed by 3 health scandals. The inquiry looked at each of them, a pregnancy test, an anti-epilepsy drug and pelvic mesh repairs, and it calls for wide-ranging improvements to the healthcare system. The chairwoman of the highly critical review, Julia Cumberledge, says the families affected also deserve a full apology from the government. She said lives were ruined because health officials didn't listen to the concerns of women.
Some of those stories I will certainly take to my grave. Their experiences were harrowing. We learnt about damaged families under immense strain, relationships that have been destroyed, and careers broken, and as a result, financial ruin.
It took 270 pages to detail the failings and the missed opportunities. Our reporter Anna Collinson has been covering the story.
It's a 2-year review. Baroness Cumberledge spoke to 700 patients and their families, mainly women who've been affected. And while these are 3 individual health scandals, there are a lot of similarities that are striking. So these 2 medications and devices were taken by women. They were never warned about the risks or told about less invasive operations or less risky medicines. When they reported problems, they weren't believed. And the main reason these 3 health scandals have come to light is because they've been led by patient-led campaign groups, often with a victim at the front of it, who's not only going through the difficulties and complications, but is also researching and leading a campaign of other victims.
Anna Collinson.
150 academics and writers have signed an open letter in the US magazine Harper's, raising concerns about threats to free speech. They include the Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who herself has faced social media outcry in recent weeks. The signatories denounce what they say is the rising intolerance of opposing views. Jonathan Savage reports.
The letter doesn't actually use the term cancel culture, but it's as good a shorthand as any for the concerns the signatories have. Cancel culture is the online shaming and boycotting of people whose views have caused offence, and sometimes means judging someone on a single incident rather than taking a person's whole contribution to society into account. It has an effect in the offline world too. People have lost jobs or seen work withdrawn after being castigated on social media. Former US President Barack Obama, not one of those to have signed the letter, highlighted the issue last year.
This idea of purity and you're never compromised and you're always politically woke and all that stuff, you should get over that quickly. The world is messy. There are ambiguities. But I do get a sense sometimes now among certain young people, and this is accelerated by social media, there is this sense sometimes of the way of me making change is to be as judgmental as possible about other people.
While cancel culture is seen as a characteristic of the left, many of the letter's signatories are left-wing or centrist and include Noam Chomsky, Margaret Atwood and Salman Rushdie. The text denounces a vogue for public shaming and ostracism and a blinding moral certainty. It says censoriousness is spreading across our culture, whereas before it was associated with the radical right. And according to signatory Anne Applebaum, it acts as a call to action.
One of the points of a letter like this one, which actually if you read it is fairly anodyne, is to put some spine into the people who run universities, newspapers and other institutions that have become afraid of Twitter mobs of different kinds.
Another writer who's put her name to the letter, J.K. Rowling, might recognise that scenario. She was recently denounced for comments that offended some transgender people and their supporters, particularly emphasising the scientific, biological definition of sex. But there is a fragile unity to this letter, which perhaps underlines the issue at play. The author and trans woman Jennifer Finney Boylan has recanted her endorsement, apparently after seeing J.K. Rowling's name on the list. "I did not know who else had signed that letter," she tweeted. "I thought I was endorsing a well-meaning, if vague, message against internet shaming. The consequences are mine to bear. I am so sorry."
Jonathan Savage reporting. George Soros, the hedge fund investor and philanthropist, has so far donated more than $32 billion to the Open Society Foundations, the international grant-making network that he founded. As a child, he survived the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Hungary before making his fortune in the UK and the US. He is widely criticised, even detested, by the far right and by some on the far left. But who is the real George Soros and what are his values? James Copnell put those questions to the journalist Emily Tamkin, who has just published her book, The Influence of George Soros.
I would say that George Soros is a figure of great influence in the realms of finance, politics, and philanthropy. And I would say that the overriding ideology of his life is this idea of open society, which is that no one of us, neither you nor I, will ever have a perfect understanding or know the perfect truth. And therefore, we must all work together through discussion and debate to arrive at a more perfect understanding. And that much of his philanthropic and political giving and much of what people resent stems from that ideology.
And that ideology, that idea of the open society, it's something he's poured just colossal amounts of money into.
Billions.
How was he able
yes.
to do that? How did he get to that point?
He worked in finance and was a hedge fund overseer and a finance man and a speculator. And then in the late 1970s said to himself, "I'm making all this money and I'm going through this physical stress and I don't know what it's for. I might as well give it to something that I believe in." And he thought, you know, the thing that I really believe in is an open society. And thus the foundation was born.
Why does that anger so many people?
the idea of an open society is fundamentally the idea that more people are participating in discussion and debate. That includes people who are traditionally marginalized. That includes people who have maybe been delegitimized or cast aside. That includes sharing political power. That is a very scary, threatening thing to many people, particularly those who are currently in power or who would maintain the status quo. And I think that when we look at why Soros is such a popular magnet for these conspiracy theorists, yes, it's because he's this like this wealthy guy and he's Jewish. And if you're American, he's foreign born. And if you're Central Eastern Europe, he's Hungarian born. And that brings with it all of these other prejudices. But the reason that it is focused in on him is that he is funding all of these causes that share political power. And so people who don't want that political power shared really zero in on him.
The criticism towards him from the right, the far right, it's fairly well known, I guess. But also there's criticism coming from the far left.
Yes. So if we are to have a society in which we are all like arguing our way toward the truth, can you really have a person who is so wealthy and so powerful taking part in that discussion without him having more weight on the scale than, say, you or I do? The problem is that there is so much out there about him that is conspiratorial, mostly from the right, some of it from the left. You know, this idea that George Soros caused the color revolutions. Did he support poll watching, or did his organization support, his foundation support poll watching in these countries? Sure. Did he in Georgia pay for government workers after Saakashvili came to power so that they wouldn't be tempted to take bribes because they were well paid? Yes, that did happen. But the idea that he himself put these revolutions in place is just not true, and it strips agency from the people who are there on the ground. All of this is to say that there is legitimate criticism, and I think part of what I try to do in my book is separate legitimate criticism from all of the noise and conspiracy theory that I think really overwhelms the conversation about what he did that was legitimately useful, what he did that was problematic, and what he did that reflects the fact that ours is the society that needs to be reformed.
Author and journalist Emily Tamkin speaking to James Copnell. Finally, Test cricket returns today for the first time since COVID-19, brought down the shutters on all sport along with much of the rest of ordinary life. England are hosting the West Indies, and the first game of the three-match series is taking place today in Southampton in southern England. Test cricket's been played for more than 140 years, but never quite like this, in a strict, isolated environment and with repeated COVID-19 testing. And as our cricket correspondent Jonathan Agnew explained, this series could be the future, in the short term at least, for international sport.
Behind the scenes, I must say there's been some extraordinary work going on by the England and Wales Cricket Board and also the West Indies Cricket Board too. You must pay huge tribute, I think, to the West Indies cricketers who have come here, and they've come from a pretty secure part of the world too. I mean, if you look, I'm afraid that the death rates, which is what we've been doing a lot of, obviously, during this coronavirus pandemic. I mean, countries like Barbados, for instance, and Jamaica, where a lot of these cricketers have come from, are single-figure deaths. They've come from really a very safe and secure part of the world, relatively speaking at least, to come here to play cricket. And we are all locked away. I mean, it's a bit like a science fiction movie, the aftermath of some sort of apocalypse, because the whole place is just completely locked down. You are scanned and sanitized and everything else several times a day. Obviously, we've been tested for the virus itself. No spectators are allowed in, of course. There are some unique rules that have been brought in specifically to allow this game to go on. I mean, if any player feels ill during the course of it, he can be immediately substituted, and that's something that simply doesn't happen in cricket. The umpire can't take the bowler's cap. If someone licks their fingers and rubs the ball, which is what they do to shine the ball, three strikes and that's five runs to the opposition and the ball's sanitised.
So this is going to work as a template for future series around the world, is it?
Well, I think it could well do. I mean, I've just come off the line to a colleague of mine in Australia on the ABC, because certainly they, with their season just around the corner, are looking very closely at how this can work. And it is all about money, of course, inevitably. And I don't mean profit, but basically if these matches didn't take place, then the local authority here, the ECB, would be looking at a loss of around about £380 million. And that's not profit. That's the money that keeps the game going, not not just at this level, but children, women's cricket, the recreational game, all the club cricket and so on that goes on throughout the country. The fact is it's absolutely essential if the game is going to be kept going, not just here, but overseas as well.
Now, very British question for you here. We had gorgeous weather at the beginning of lockdown in England. What does it look like now?
Well, typically, it's a bit damp. But then that would be English cricket weather for you, wouldn't it?
That was Jonathan Agnew in Southampton. And it will come as little surprise to people who follow English cricket and indeed English summertime that the start of play today was delayed by rain. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or tell us how much you've missed cricket, or you want to send us more of your animal pictures, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.